Are y'all ready? Y'all ready?
Do you have a question?
Question.
Questions, Mary?
Well, I think they figured it out, but I'm not sure. The last of my notes, it said Theta Three, which is Lower Trinity, often symbolized by three women. A symbolic thinking, and then South. South was the number one. Is that right? And you said something about three and one and three.
It's confusing. Let me try it again. Because the Lower Trinity is going to come up again. And we've got the Holy Trinity, right? That's the starting point. And that psychologically means that there is a guidance from the unconscious in the psychological realm, putting it most simply. In other words, your dreams, your fantasies. That's the fact that they evolve is evidence of the upper trinity on the psychological plane. And that's standard theology. You know, basically, Jung is not quibbling with the church's description of the phenomena that the Holy Spirit refers to in their mind. He just doesn't feel he can call it holy or not holy. He just calls it spirit. Okay, so far so good. But, of course, as we know, the early and more differentiated images of God are always quaternities. So that Trinity leaves out one part. And now this is where it gets logically contradictory, but psychologically accurate. That one thing that's missing, you could talk about as a one or a three. Logically, it doesn't make sense, but psychologically, it does make sense. You could think that the image of the Trinity leaves out one, which is the earth, which is the guiding function of experiences that come to us in an earthly form. We've talked about it in different paradigms, sex, of course, being one of the primary ones, eros, desire, erotic desire. Psychosomatic disease, I think, is another way that the spirit speaks through the material world. Synchronicity is another example where guidance comes through the physical world. Any experience that comes to you through the activation of your instincts and emotions in a passionate way, that doesn't have to be positive, could be negative, a negative feeling. So that life throws you into a negatively felt event that has you enraged. That can provide as much guidance as any other experience, is Jung's position. Okay, that's the spirit in the earth. And that spirit in the earth can be conceived of as a spirit in the earth. And it can also be in a single earth, or it can also be conceived of as a lower trinity. So that one is actually three. And the way it's usually symbolized is three women, because the upper trinity is masculine, the lower trinity is feminine. And usually three dark women. I think the three witches in Macbeth are classic images. They really predict the whole play, you see. So that's the spirit in the lower trinity, which is the earth, which is three, which is one. Does that help?
Which is three, which is one.
Which is, yeah.
One being a quaternity?
Well, you could conceive of that missing fourth as one, or you could conceive of the missing fourth as three. I know, it doesn't make logical sense. It doesn't make logical sense. In other words, I always have to take people back. Remember, in your dreams, you can be in Paris and Rome at the same time. See, these logical contradictions don't bother dreams. So sometimes the dreams will personify that spirit in the earth as one thing, one woman, one rock. Mary brought a little rock she found with spirit written on it. Or it can personify it as three. And it, psychologically, it means the same thing. And generally, it's three women. And then Jung just plays with it a little bit in the symmetry of the fact that we've got a higher trinity in a lower trinity. And that lower trinity is that missing fourth.
Of the higher trinity.
Of the higher trinity. Or you could, yeah. You have to be willing to accept contradictions for this to make sense. Logical contradictions. As I say, the dream, you know, we're going to see the stranger. See, that's one. He's going to be the missing fourth. And we're also going to see the, you know, the three, we'll see three spindles, and we saw the three sticks. Three sticks are the form of the stranger when he was in the river. So, see, the dreams don't mind these contradictions. And again, it's that lower trinity is seen surprisingly often. You know, there'll be three gangsters, or there'll be three hookers, or there'll be three pieces of candy. And you immediately think, oh, this is what we're dealing with. And you can be sure when you hear the person's story, you'll be hearing a story about some worldly event that has become problematic that the therapy is trying to turn into a guiding experience. That help very very. It's another word. Sophia would be the fourth as one. Lower Trinity would be the fourth as three, but they all represent the same thing.
But we look at Sophia as the one of the lower Trinity.
She'd be three in one.
Yeah.
Just like you could have God as three in one. So in the lower Trinity, you could have three in one, or you could have three, and it's the same. So she would be three in one. Or you could have the three parts symbolized separately, but as generally as a group. And I think, you know, if you can remember that Trinity is an arrow, that is what's so helpful to me. It's this movement forward, but in the earth. So, like you could say, the triangle is one thing, although it's three-sided. Sometimes the dream will emphasize the oneness of it, sometimes the dream will emphasize the threeness of it.
Gary, was there a reason his three bones were in this shape rather than a completed triangle?
No. I mean, I'm sure there is. I don't know if I could describe it. Other than that, that seems to emphasize the arrow quality. But who knows?
Well, I had an association with that. You know, when the peace movement created the symbol that is known as the peace symbol, it was Bertrand Russell who combined the semaphores for N and D, which stands for nuclear disarmament. And the symbol, the three sticks, is in that general shape. And with Pally's taste for the military uses of
N. Yeah, I bet archetypally it's related. Yeah. That's a counter-movement that's trying to fight for the earth. And that's where we see these images, when the earth is at stake. All we're doing is adding the spirit. He's using the earth as its vehicle.
You look at the Christian cross, the cross, the opposites are too high.
Right.
Whereas that one is going down.
Right.
The earth,
right.
It's beginning to try to lower that.
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Good. Yeah, that's a good point, too. Yeah, the weight on that one is at the bottom.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, Celtic mythology shows that feminine energy going from the three to the one. It has their triple goddess, and she's related to, and eventually she becomes Brigid, the unitary goddess, who's a Sophia type of energy.
Yeah, you've got it. You've got it. I didn't know about the Celtic reference, but I'm sure there. You've got it, of course, in Greece in the Three Fates. And Hecate, you know, the witch, is often said to be three-headed.
And Persephone, there's Demeter, Persephone, and Hecate. Or who's the crone who helps Persephone?
Balbo. Balbo is definitely in this area. Think of Bette Midler, and that's Balbo.
Yeah.
sells her underwear?
She shows more than her underwear.
She doesn't have underwear on.
Neither does Balbo.
That's what I meant.
Oh, yeah.
Good. Yeah. I saw this, I saw Balbo when I was over in France. This little village has a summer festival. They are absolutely vulgar with each other. They're racketing each other the finger, making obscene gestures among friends. Mm-hmm. And I just think, well, here's Balbo, you know. It's all done in good fun, and probably relieving some sexual tension that they might feel in village life. That's Balbo, this acceptance of the earth, and that's the Lower Trinity. Yeah.
Native Americans have that too.
Do they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they call them clowns, but koshares.
But this is everybody doing it, you know. You'll be sitting in Costa Rica and somebody will be flipping the bird or sticking their finger in their mouth like this. Whoa. You know, here would be a fight. But there it's like good fun.
It sounds like an Oktoberfest, too.
Yeah, you can see this dimension of the feminine coming up often in, ritualistic or in ceremonial events. She's not integrated, but we do have a little spot where she can come out. Yeah.
Mardi Gras.
Mardi Gras, yeah.
Is it Beltane? Is that what it is? The Beltane celebration? Oh, yes, I am. I showed you a picture of that in the vision class. It's a Celtic celebration where they paint themselves in red and
Right. Right. And the Celts, I think, are particularly important here. He doesn't have much Celtic in him, though the Swiss do. The Swiss are very Celtic. I don't know if you were aware of that, but these European license plates, where they have like D for Deutschland and F for France. You see, it's CH for Switzerland. That means Confederation Helvetica. And the Helvetica is a Celtic goddess. So it's really, if you look on there, I think it's their 10 centime piece. She's on there. Mm-hmm. Because they were all over. I mean, they were the foundation of Europe at one. What later became Europe at one time. But just I think a beautiful thing about the Celtic. This is not really about Pali, but as far as I know, the Celtic tradition is or culture is the only one where that woman is transformed by love and not power. The myth of sovereignty. Y'all know that myth. Very. I'll tell it just real briefly. Like she would be in her negative sense the dragon, so the dragon would be the unredeemed feminine that is unable to carry the spirit. What we have to do is transform her into be strong enough to deal with her so she can guide us, which is in a way kind of Pali's problem. He can't contain her. He meets her with Ravana's. That's her. But in the myth of sovereignty, three brothers get lost. And they have to go fetch water, and the first two go find a well, and an old hag comes out and says they can have water if they'll kiss her, and she's so ugly they throw up. And the third one then goes out and he says, "Kiss you, I'll show you," and he throws her on the ground and makes love to her. As he is making love to her, she turns into a beautiful woman, and then she says, "I'm sovereignty. I'm the queen of the land, and since you have accepted me, you're now king of the realm. But you have to make a decision whether you want me to be beautiful in the day and ugly at night, or beautiful at night and whatever is the opposite in the day." And he says, "Well, your choice." And she says, "Well, since you're giving me my choice, I'll be beautiful all the time." And it's called the myth of sovereignty. And see, that's that dragon fight through love. And that's really, in a way, what we're trying to do here is deal with this feminine experience that's going to be coming his way from Von Franz, which is going to be the Lower Trinity. Not by the old method of willpower, let's get over it, but going into it, letting it guide in this case, Pali, toward his work, which is a radical shift in the understanding of the relationship between the ego and the feminine in our time. All our myths are based on us controlling the feminine. Every one of them. Okay? Let's just do a quick review. Remember we left off with Dream 10? A dark man goes into a river. Basically, then he comes out again, and he is a mixture of light and dark. We talked about him as the unification of those previous two figures, the Persian and the blonde. Does that all make sense? So that what's happening in Pali is this idea of synchronicity is becoming closer to him and more personal. Before he had an idea of synchronicity as it applied to science, and then he had an idea of it as it applied to him. The first would be the blonde, second would be the Persian, and that allows him this compartment psychology where he really doesn't have to get the two sides of himself together and live both his work and his personal life as unity, but here there is beginning to be some synthesis. So that what the unconscious is driving at is that he both sees the synchronicity, the challenge synchronicity is putting to science, and the challenge is going to be putting to him. So if you're going to talk about science recognizing synchronicity, you also have to talk about it, what it's asking you to do in your own life. And that's the lower trinity. And the other detail, I think, in that dream was the three sticks on the ground were the stranger's post-mortal effects, which just shows the relationship between synchronicity and the stranger, that the synchronicity is the manifestation of the stranger in time and space. Okay, any questions? So we go to 47, I think. Oh, while I'm thinking about, before we get started, just some show and tell real quick. I watched a video that Tom suggested. I made two copies. I thought it was okay. As always, it doesn't do justice to the issue. But I made two copies. If you want to watch it, you're welcome. You know, pass it around or do whatever you want. I don't care.
What was the subject?
Well, it's Isaac Newton and how he was both a scientist and an alchemist. And they kind of
religiously. That was the second half. Was about religious
heresy. And they kind of belittle him for being an alchemist. You know, I just get so sick of that. I thought I might read you just real briefly. You know this book by Dave Lindorf that I showed you, the Pali book. You know on Amazon how you can review books. Well, there's a review by a medical doctor. I thought I'd read you one paragraph to show you the same kind of arrogance. If you go to, it's on, just go to, what's the book called? Pali and Jung, The Meaning of Two Great Minds. It's on Amazon. I'm just going to read a real quick part. More than half of the treatise, nay 75%, deals with Pali's recital of dreams spanning some 25 years for Jung to analyze. So we have embarked on a phantasmal, supernatural, and primordial journey into the imaginary, discarnate world of apparition. See, that's the scientist speaking for you. And it's stupid, too. Archetypal imagery bearing a host of titular Greek names such as mandala, a causal connecting principle, blah, blah, blah. For mythologists, this could be a precious piece of prose, but frankly, I'd expect readership to be severely wanting. The book is not about God, nor about religion, but much closer to an ideology embracing magic, mystery, palmistry, phrenology, and peeking at Peking tea leaves. So you see how this material is greeted by collective consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Which means I'll buy it.
Which is also,
yeah, and if you do read it, you might go to this website and put in your own two cents. Yeah. I think I will.
Is the author of that review. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the problem. This material is threatening to the old king, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I'm tempted to write a response, but my name isn't on the book, and I don't know if that might sort of disqualify me. So.
No.
So I may do it anyway.
So is this Wikipedia? This is not Amazon?
No, that's Amazon.
Use a pseudonym.
What?
So when you post, your email name is listed.
Oh.
I could call it a hot day, but
see, I was right.
Okay, the next, Linda just if you're interested. Smithsonian, August 2005, has an article about Oppenheimer. And here's this thing about Freud. It was March 27th. So, okay, that's all. Back to work. Page 47. These next couple of dreams are not, I don't think, that utterly crucial. We will come up to one that is pretty crucial. But what, where, you know, I felt, for example, the last one was very, very important. You can kind of feel some of these are more important than others. So we don't have to, you know, dwell on these. But it will give us a chance to reflect on our understanding of synchronicity and some of the problems that come when you try to define it. So remember that the dream last time came after Jung and Pauli talked, I think, for the first time seriously, I'm not sure, over lunch or coffee or a glass of wine, who knows, about synchronicity. And Pauli had encouraged Jung to publish on it. As early as, I think, 1928, I think, is the first reference in Jung's collected works to the word synchronicity. Or he may not even use the word, he just explains the concept. And, you know, he was afraid to publish on it because he was afraid of getting shot down, I think, by people like that. And having Pauli, a scientist, backing him up, I think gave him the courage to publish on it. So that dream came from Pauli after their discussion. And as do these, then, followed on the heels. Dream 11, an airplane lands out of which unknown people disembark. The voice of the stranger says you mustn't exaggerate your difficulties with the time concept. The dark girl has only to make a small journey in order to achieve definite time. The thing that Pauli was getting him to clarify was, what's the relationship between a synchronicity and time? Do they have to be simultaneous? And Jung was saying no, out of that discussion, I think. In other words, you know, let's suppose you have a dream of my friend, you know, well, that's not a bad example. That's a bad example because it wasn't a dream. Well, Sandy's example that she said we could talk about, of having a dream about a bear claw and then seeing bear claw buttons like a day or two later. That's classical synchronicity. Suppose she had had a bear claw dream 2 years ago and had a experience of bear claw buttons. Is that still a synchronicity? Jung's feeling is yes. And the way I have defined it for myself, which is probably not exactly opposite, is a synchronicity is a coincidence between an inner state of mind and an outer event, which is actually not quite accurate. And that's what Jung see, the body wants to be included. the fine tuning Jung did was, it is a, it's going to sound silly, but it's not really, a coincidence between an inner state of mind and a perception of an outer event. What's the difference? The difference is, if the perceiving of that event gives you the willies, then it's a synchronicity. He calls it a coincidence between two psychic states, which again sounds a bit unclear, but what he means is that an act of perception is a psychic state, as is an inner mood or inner dream. It's a psychic state. So that clarification came out of...
Would you say that these practices of some sport talents to imagine the home run, or imagine the three-point shots and imagine the whole competition, would that at all be included in synchronicity?
It's a tough question. Where do you draw the line between synchronicity and magic? I would hate to... For me, it's a gray area. I mean, where it comes down to... I am not big on the power of positive thinking. But I have to tell people, and I tell myself, I am pretty sure about the power of negative thinking. So somewhere between those two extremes, I think there's a place to reside. I mean, I tell people who are looking for either a job or a relationship or an inspiration to imagine having it. Not to try to will it, but to put oneself in a condition to receive it when it comes.
And so, to be able to see it.
And to be able to see it. Because often you're so down on your luck that a miracle is given to you and you don't see it. But I think, you know, if you allow me some gray area, strictly speaking, to wish something to happen is contrary to the spirit of synchronicity. Because what we're trying to do is see where the spirit is. Now, I am not saying also that your wish and the spirit can't be aligned. So I say that realizing there are plenty of examples you'd give me where you would force me to contradict myself. But basically, I would be careful about wishing or imagining events. And I might say, put it this way, that aggrandize the ego. You know, if your child is sick, yeah. If you need an inspiration to write a book because you have a good idea which you know will serve the human community, yeah. It's where it turns into egocentric stuff that I think we've got to be careful.
Is that the same as saying, because there's a wish, there's a will, right? I mean, you're wishing for something,
yeah.
You're not willing it.
Right.
You can't will synchronous.
Theoretically, no.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. The basic idea is that the spirit is an independent reality, and it's the way. It indicates the way, and what we need to do is to use our willpower to discern the way, and then use our willpower to complete that way. For example, Pali did not want to have complicated feelings for Von Franz. But again, I think depending on where you are, for example, with young people, I would almost try to tell them to will a synchronicity. You know, will that you get a good job. I mean, go around meditating on the fact that a good job is going to come your way, or the right relationship is going to come your way.
Then it won't have been a coincidence.
Because I think at that point, the spirit and the ego are so close that the spirit is trying to build up the ego at that point, that they can get away with it. But at our age, where our ego is, you know, pretty well adapted, or relatively well adapted, the spirit changes its focus, and it starts working against the ego and for the self. But you can't work for the self if you can't pay your mortgage. And that's what young people have to do, is get all these basic needs in place. So it is complicated. But certainly you can see that one danger is that you put your will in the place of God, which is magic. And or another danger, that you're so negative that you don't see what good things are coming your way. That's what I was saying there, is at the bottom of 47. In the final analysis, the distinguishing feature was the simultaneity of two psychic states, not of a psychic and a physical one, meaning a intrapsychic and a perceptive psychic. That's where he says on the third line, that's Jung talking, at the top of the page, or 48, psychic images in the present. It's a small point. It's a real small point.
But also, the final community, you said no, you don't have to be simultaneous.
Well, but it is simultaneous if you realize that your perception and the interstate coincide. That's how he's trying to get out of that difficulty.
Okay.
Does that make sense? It's, in a way, I think it's really splitting hairs, but, you know, remember, Jung's trying to be very precise for the scientific community. So, let's say, you know, Sandy has a dream of bear claws, and then a year later sees a bear claw. That act of perception is a psychic event as much as the dream was a psychic event. That's what he's trying to say. So that even though that dream was long ago, its memory is still psychologically present. And that's what makes it a synchronicity. It's, as I say, this is not real important. It's a field point. I think if you want to, you know, just carry a rule of thumb, you think of synchronicity as an A causal coincidence between an inner state of mind and an outer event.
So when the accident or whatever you want to call it happens after the dream, that psychic state is being influenced by the event itself. So it's not the same as the original.
Right. Right. That's a good way to put it. There's still a perseveration.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then it makes it meaningful to the person in a unique way.
Right. And then out of that event, they receive, by interpreting that event, some knowledge of how their life should unfold.
So if I hadn't remembered that dream, if it had been a year,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't remember that dream, then...
It would not be a synchronicity, right. According to his definition.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I think it's splitting here.
No, that's pretty important.
Yeah, that one works, I think.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
It's not splitting here.
Because they work both psychic
right.
events.
Yeah, that's what he's trying to get at, I think. Yeah.
It seems to me that sometimes we can only see the synchronicity of an event after we've gone through it and get to that other side and looking back
yeah.
and saying, oh my God, you know, that job was there right when I needed it.
Yeah.
Or even the person we married, when you come through it and see, aha, that's why I ended up with that person.
Right.
But while I'm in it, I don't see it.
Yeah, and maybe I'm saying the same thing you are in a different way to see, but in other words, present and past events sometimes cannot be understood until there's another future event.
Mm-hmm.
This is why we loathe all this reductive work in my field. Because it's saying that the present can only be interpreted in terms of the past. But we're saying, wait a minute, the present and the past can be interpreted in terms of the future. Very, very big difference. Which is actually, I think, that's a Hebrew idea. I don't think that's new to Jung.
The future?
Yeah, that their travails of history would make sense in terms of some future event. That's pretty standard, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Yeah. That's why I love the Hebrews, I think. They really articulated that. Again, it's not to deny the importance, I always feel I have to say that, of going back to the past, but in the final analysis, we need a larger context, and that's what the future provides. Because what you may be having in a certain tragic moment in your life is the first half of a synchronicity,
mm-hmm.
and you just think you're getting screwed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it gives you the willing.
Yeah.
As you said.
So would that be anti-Freud too? The future of unspringing?
Oh yeah, he wouldn't. There's no teleology in Freud that I can see. Now, what we're doing here is, you know, kind of a nice theoretical discussion, but as far as Pali goes, it seems to me that the dreamer, the author, really kind of didn't stress the point, which I would have stressed, which is the role of the dark anima. The dark girl only has to make a small journey in order to achieve time. That's his experience with von Franz. It's being anticipated. The dark girl is his sexuality. Or his spirituality experienced in a erotic way.
I don't understand why you say that. How do you say
that? Oh, because that's where he felt passion, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, it's where he felt real passion.
And an intellect, too. It was both.
Right.
The double whammy.
It was a double whammy. Yeah.
That's based on some other writings.
What is based?
Where he had passion.
Oh, we'll get there.
Oh, it's in here.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It doesn't come yet. But we'll see. She enters the stage.
Oh,
she's
okay.
Entering the stage pretty soon. But they really don't. I've got to find out the exact timeline. You know, unfortunately, don't have any of her letters. But that's what we're talking about.
Would he had any ability to interpret that as that happened?
No.
Probably
not.
Is his dream trying to comfort him, too, that it's not going to be overwhelming by saying it's only a small journey? Like,
I hadn't thought of that, but I bet you're right.
Don't get overwhelmed.
Don't get overwhelmed, right. So that the dream is pointing up the theoretical issues that Pali is trying to understand. And there I think he was partly right to question Jung. And it's also saying, but this is going to be more than a theoretical experience for you, and that's why the dark girl is there.
It's funny that Jung has to point out probably that time is relative. You think that the topmost one probably is mine.
Well, that's a good point. You can see the split between the Persian and the blonde. You know, if you would be discussing physics, you would get that. But when you're discussing life, he has trouble with that. There's an example of the split. Same concept, but it's received differently depending on the area. That make sense to everybody? Yeah. If you want to, I was going to read it, but I think the second time I'll skip it. Pali's comments to Jung are in Adam and Archetype on page 38 and following. You can read it if you're reader if you've got it.
You said 38
and following. And it's nothing we haven't talked about. It's just in Adam and Archetype. In this one.
Oh, okay. Page
31.
No, in
this book. No, in this book. This is the letter, remember? Okay, that takes us to the middle of 48. Again, kind of a theoretical dream in some respects, but in some respects I think kind of an important dream. Although I don't agree with the interpretation, so we'll try to see where we stand. A blonde woman and three children are present. Two dark boys and a light girl. The woman is obviously the mother of the children. The small girl very much resembles her, and I forgot. Oh, no, I didn't, but I still haven't got this translated right. Much resembles her mother, and I think, as if she were a further development or a continued development of the mother. Forget that Cleve stuff. I say that I think a lot of the talent of the older boy, but I have doubts about the younger one. The blonde woman, the mother, contradicts me very passionately, defending the younger boy. Another mother disappears with the boys, and I remain alone with the small girl, the daughter. Then I see that she is reading a book, which seems very difficult. Suddenly she says to me, "There, my teacher is coming." And soon a large, light, dark man comes. So here's the stranger again. He explains to me the normal mathematics is still too difficult for her. Thus, for the time being, I must give her popular mathematics books. Now I see Gothic letters in the book she is reading, but I cannot make out the words clearly. It probably goes on a bunch of crap, I think, about the I Ching. I don't see any reason to say the I Ching is popular mathematics. How in the world would you get there? It's about the most unpopular point of view for the West that exists. So I don't buy that. But now he picks up. It is certainly important that in the dream, no dark girl is present. The dark anima mentioned in the January 38 dream discussed in Chapter 2, who wanted to publish a dream on time symbolism, had no representative in the dream. That was the clock dream. Remember that very early on. Even though the blonde and the Persian have amalgamated into one figure, the anima is obviously still split into a light and a dark half. In a correspondence with Jung, Pauli interpreted this split as follows. The light feminine is the erotic spiritual and often appears as the preliminary stage of the formation of a concept, whereas the dark feminine usually tends toward the realization of a situation in the material world, external nature. I also don't agree with that. I think it's the other way around. The dark woman is the preliminary stage of the formation of a concept, which is symbolized by the light feminine. Does that make sense?
No.
I know, I didn't get it in.
I think it has to do with the role of sex in creativity. That often the new project comes in the form of a relationship.
Not necessarily sexual?
Sorry.
That reminds me, you know, I mentioned last time that Schrodinger going away.
Yeah.
With his mistress.
Yeah, because he projected it all. Now, sex or erotic? That's the question, I think. We've talked about it several times, but it's not an immediately understandable idea. So do we not need to talk about the relationship between sex and eros? Remember, Jung has that couple of paragraphs in Psychology of the Transference where he goes through the four stages of eros, which I can never remember. Eve, Helen,
Mary,
and Sophia. The eros would be the principle of relationship. That's even pretty abstract for most of us mere mortals. I would say eros, you know, I'm paraphrasing it, eros is that the feeling of either being in contact or wanting to be in contact with somebody in a way that touches your heart. And if it's with the opposite sex, it's eros, and if it's with the same sex, it's agape.
That's which?
Agape. This is very simplified, but it's, these are such difficult concepts that I'm just trying to give us a place to start. We could always fine-tune down the road. It's the longing. to be with that person that you feel filled with. Now, the first way that surfaces is, I think, sex for everybody. I forgot where I said. I said it in another context. You know, you rarely hear guys in a locker room saying, "Wow, I met this new chick. She's very articulate." But women might say that.
It's code for no. I'm just kidding.
That's where it surfaces for most of us, and I bet you would not hear many 18-year-old girls talking that way. Oh, he's very articulate.
No, they like his tush.
Yeah, yeah. So, see, that's already an evolution of eros. That what pulls you in isn't just the physical experience, but it's other things.
But even 18-year-olds get charmed by the word.
I think there's a difference between men and women. Mm-hmm. But I'm just trying to give you a sense of how you know, we say sex and eros as if they're interchangeable, and that's really not true. But at the first level of manifestation, when people are awakening to desire, that's often how it mm-hmm. manifests. But then, what gives you that feeling that the sexual attraction used to give you changes away from the purely physical to other qualities? For a man speaking now, I think Helen would represent how the gracefulness and atmosphere and light touch of a woman can pull him in. And Mary would represent how he sees the way she mothers her children, and that pulls him to her. And I think Sophia would be, he is pulled in by her wisdom, but I think most of us never get there.
And what is Eve?
Eve is just the physical. Now, I went through all that because my feeling is when creativity starts, the ideas that want to be expressed occur simultaneous with the manifestation of eros in the person's life. So a relationship and an idea often go hand in hand. When it's time to start a new book, a new attraction emerges. Now, for most of us, it's going to be somewhere between Eve and Helen, probably, for guys anyway.
What is it for women? Who are these four?
Oh, what are the four men? Tarzan.
Hero.
Yeah.
Warrior.
Hero.
Word.
Magician. What is it, Jane? Hero, word, priest, and then wise old man.
Yeah, hero. So the deed, the word.
Mm-hmm. The deed, the word. Priest, the spiritual.
The meaning.
Meaning.
No, no. The spirit, maybe, and meaning. Tony Rule. She wrote about that.
She wrote about
that.
Yeah. Hero, word, and the
word.
A deed, word.
And then wise old man. Action.
No, it's physical. Deed, word, and meaning. Mm-hmm. First is Tarzan, and then, like, say, Churchill, a man of action with resolve. Word, the poets, meaning Gandhi.
Okay.
Physical, deed, word, and meaning? No.
Mm-hmm. Deed. Physical attraction, action.
Action.
Or action or deed.
Okay. Oh, action or deed.
Yeah.
Okay, so deed is with the physical.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then word.
Deed is with the action.
Yeah.
Hero action. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, like,
so that's one.
That I mean, like Donald Trump. I think he's ugly as sin, but...
He is.
But he... But he gets...
I'm sure Mary on. I just think he's ugly.
He gets money.
But what's attractive is he gets things done.
Yeah.
He's a man of action.
Power.
Yeah, power. But not just power, but the ability to use it to do things.
Okay.
Leaders.
So that's, but then at another level, you want things to be done that are you know, you distinguish between.
Yeah, but look how few people care that he's a criminal.
Yeah.
Right. See what I mean? Yeah. Just that he gets things done is enough to pull how many 30-year-old lawyers into his business, all gaga-ing after him. See what I mean? Right. The next step would be, but you know what? You're a crook.
Yeah. What about that?
What about that? See, that doesn't affect the woman's eros if she's in the second level.
Another way of looking at it is that
in
action.
Mm-hmm. The Enron people who are on trial now, they're not looked up on as really bad guys, really.
Right. Because they got things done.
Yeah.
Tarzan. That's the cute tush stage, is the first.
All right. Okay.
And then the second one, you get things done, but you don't.
So that's
between
the
motive behind it.
Need an action or second after physical.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's why the war.
I think they're getting it.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the last is me.
The wise old man.
So physical attractiveness.
Okay.
Ability to act and do in deeds would be the second. Third would be aware of meaning.
No, third
is
words.
Third is words. Fourth is meaning.
Okay, so I think on both of second and third, you reach the point where you differentiate between whether just do it for whatever reason or motive and what the outcome is. And words, the same thing. I mean, they could have a lot of fancy words, but, mm-hmm. but if it doesn't really mean anything,
right.
that word has sub-meanings. So you have to kind of, there's two different levels with each of those second and mm-hmm. thirds, I think.
Mm-hmm. But do you remember, like in Amadeus, he's seducing his future wife at a party, and it's a woman is trying to seduce him, and he says, "Oh, but I'm this and that," and he says, "Oh, I'm ugly or something like that," and she says, "But looks are not important to a woman of cultural taste." What impressed her was his creative ability, mm-hmm. and the fact that he was a scoundrel too didn't bother her. So I think even in the third stage, there is no real ethical sense. That's how women fall for sweet talkers. The words are great. The guys are saying, "Jesus, but can't you see?" And she's all...
I'll look up Tony Wilson and bring it in.
Bring it in.
Okay.
I think we're more or less on.
Yeah, I think we are too.
Well,
you have different words.
Creativity with us?
Any of them, I think, could have. See, the first one, the Tarzan, would be, you know, reproduction. Making beautiful babies, because he's strong and beautiful. The second would be, I think that's how Hitler could have worked. He got things done. And that, in a way, is creative. It doesn't have to, I mean, productive might be a better word. Think of all the business deals that have been pulled on people's eyes by sweet talk.
But that first one is where all the worship comes from of athletes and stars.
Yeah, right.
You know, that when you're a high schooler and you're just like, oh, it's funny, you know,
mm-hmm.
Frank Sinatra or Elvis or
yeah.
whoever, that
mm-hmm.
that all comes
yeah.
out of that.
Yeah, it doesn't bother people that Frank Sinatra hung out with the mafia.
No. But it's usually teenage mm-hmm. girls who are following to that,
mm-hmm.
that worship of that hero,
mm-hmm.
whatever he is, whether he's a singer, an athlete, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now,
infidelity
didn't
bother.
No.
My whole point was just to get us to understand the breadth of what eros is.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was trying to say was when creativity strikes, eros is often activated as well.
Karen, my understanding is that Eros is that creative moment. Like there's two books I'm reading right now. One's called Dewey and Eros, and it's this whole idea that how do you evoke passion and creativity in education, and it is through an erotic principle which is unrelated to the flesh. It's related to creativity. And another one is called Chaos and Eros, in which this woman argues that Eros, that the opposite of chaos is an order. The opposite of chaos is Eros, because it creates it's a creative spark that creates a relationship. But it isn't always to another person. But Eros is a much broader idea than that. And I only say that because I think that amplifies this. It's not just this relationship he's coming into with Lanfranc, it's this relationship that he's experiencing with this whole creative energy that he's engaged in, a part of which is manifesting in this relationship. So I'm just suggesting Eros is bigger than between human beings.
Yeah, that's a good point. I partly agree with you and I partly disagree with you. I think another way to put it would be that these are Eros moments, and Eros is the connecting principle, and it surfaces in two dimensions, in creative work and in personal relationship. That might be a better way to put it. And what creativity is, it's making new connections, and that goes to the product of your work and to your relationship.
So this woman in this book, Chaos and Eros, I think it's so beautiful because she says we think it's the opposite of chaos is order, which concretizes and systematizes ways, things in ways that human beings can't live in, because you don't live that. When we try to live that order, you get fundamentalism.
Mm-hmm.
But what Eros does, the opposite of chaos being Eros, is it allows for the messiness. It makes you understand that when those things get activated, we live in a world that brings with it the kinds of things you were talking about, things that long feel real ethical or whatever, but it doesn't diminish the creative moment that you're in.
I see what you're saying. So the chaos and Eros go together.
Well, she's saying that Eros is the opposite of chaos.
I don't see that at all. I think it's the evolution of the chaos.
I shouldn't say opposite. She said chaos and in order are not at opposite poles. That what chaos is really moving toward is Eros, which is relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't necessarily mean an ordered way of being. Bring with it a lot of disorder.
That
erotic attraction creates chaos in your life, and out of that comes the possibility. That's another way of looking at it.
Right. That's how I would see it, yeah.
Or you can see chaos as a big multiplicity of connections, so much so that you don't understand it, and it seems unordered.
Yeah, I'm not sure where to go on all the fine points, but what I just want to leave you with is how relationship and creativity connect. And relationship sounds so sanitary, but it's not. Now, going to Tom's question, does that mean there has to be a sexual relationship? No, it does mean there has to be a relationship of Eros. And probably, for us mere mortals, that is not going to occur without some erotic aspect to it. Because that's where we get it.
Well, is that where withdrawing projections comes in, then?
Right.
It would be an unconscious projection.
Right. But, you know, the odd thing about withdrawing projections is before you withdraw them, you have to make them.
Oh.
I would say that you're not in charge of that. That you're not in charge of the projection.
Right.
No, it is unconscious.
It comes through you, and then it will withdraw when it is ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It has its own life.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. How do we get off on that?
I just wanted to know about the feminine side. That's all.
Yeah.
Oh, it was the dark anima and the
ego
and synchronicity. How it is that the dark anima? Because your question, how it is that the dark anima gets involved when the creative process is activated?
And you started by disagreeing with this quote. You said it should be in reverse.
Oh, that's it. Yes, thank you. Where was that?
Middle 49.
Right. The light feminine. So I would say the dark feminine is the erotic material. Erotic dash material. And often appears as the preliminary stage of the formation of the concept, which is the light feminine. Does that make sense? Very, very important.
Say it again.
If I were going to rewrite that, the dark feminine is the erotic dash material and often appears as the preliminary stage of the formation of the concept. Whereas the light feminine usually tends toward the realization of a creation in the material world. So first you get the desire, and then you get the inspiration. And it's probably not one, two, but these two things occur. But you realize you can probably will yourself out of the creative project, but it's a lot harder to will yourself out of the attraction. So the Eros rivets you to a situation.
There is one small point I think that you were referring to. Most of the writings of Jung is from the standpoint of the animal and men, isn't it? But
no, I don't think so.
It's not. But
really?
Well, let me finish my little.
Okay, go ahead.
Very small part.
Maybe not.
But I assume that, like with Freud, that most of the people analyzed were women.
Jung work was different too.
Yeah, but the writing is mostly from the dreams of dream material men.
See, that requires a couple of questions. Should we take a break and then come back?